Welcome to episode 2 to the 5th power. That's right, it's 32, opening today, which would be May 8th, 2007, unless you're listening to this episode later, in which case it's like however many days earlier that it... All right, kicking things off, we got a top 6 celebrating Mother's Day, which is next weekend, the top 6 movie moms. And following that, the trivia question, as usual. Then we got an industry trends segment about 3D. And then we'll conclude the Looney Tunes segments that we've been doing. And wrapping things up, we got another cinematographic kind of term that Stephen is going to define for us on the Film Buffs Dictionary. I am Sam Stoddard.
I'm Stephen Keller. And that's your cue to put on the 3D glasses that were included with your download of this podcast, so you can see me, Stephen Keller, in three dimensions. Isn't that awesome?
Stephen?
Yeah.
This is not a visual, it's just audio only.
Oh.
You're talking about the 3D headphones that you have to download, and you hear it in 3D.
So I
know you're confused about the technical aspects, but I thought we had that straight before.
Well, I haven't listened. I need to... You're going to explain 3D to me, right? So then I guess I'll understand. But I think you have to wear...
I haven't done that yet.
You have to wear the glasses, right? Those little cardboard things? I got a pair on right now.
That's not if you don't have a picture. It's audio only for this podcast.
So 3D headphones. Okay, I'm going to go on the website and get those.
It's Mother's Day, or at least it will be before we get back to you next week, so we'd like to take the opportunity to dedicate this top 6 segment to mothers everywhere. Well, I would. Stephen, I just have a sneaking suspicion that mothers are not going to want his part of this dedicated to them. But let's kick things off. We're talking about movie mothers, the top 6 mothers in the movies that have made some sort of impression, good or bad. And my number 6 title is actually sort of unintuitively named Life with Father, centering on the father as the main character, played by William Powell. And he has just got to be one of the most hilariously difficult men to be married to. So the mother is really shining here, sort of in the background, you know, behind every great man there's a woman, that kind of thing. Well, anyway, the man, he's got this tremendously strong personality and a short fuse and these strict demands about life. It has to be exactly how he wants it. He wants his household run in good order and his children to be in line and all this kind of things. He is a sympathetic character, though, which is kind of hard to pull off, the type of character that can still be sympathetic. But this movie does that. And the wife, I think, really adds a lot of balance and humor and heart to this movie because, well, she's played by Irene Dunne, and she's just incredibly smart and insightful. Absolutely nothing gets by her. She can instantly assess the dynamics of some sort of social or family situation, and you know, she sees when her husband is blundering right through something like an ox in a china shop, and she also knows exactly what to do to steer him in the right direction and save the day. You know, a little smile and suggestion and an ingenious way of putting something, and miraculously, difficult problems get solved. So, you know, again, in a lesser movie, I think even that type of character wouldn't be terribly sympathetic, but I think there's a real affection for both of these in this movie, Life with Father from 1947. They're perfectly matched together.
You know, I'm kind of offended, Sam, that you think mothers wouldn't appreciate being included on my list. You don't even know what I've picked.
I know you, though. So, well, prove me wrong. Go ahead.
Well, my number 6 pick is going to be Pamela Voorhees, played by Betsy Palmer in the first Friday the 13th movie. Fans of the Friday the 13th series will remember that in the first film, it is not Jason doing the killing, but his mother killing the camp counselors who she feels are responsible for his drowning death some years before. And, you know, who wouldn't want their mother to avenge their death in bloody and gruesome ways? You know, I mean, sure, she gets killed for her trouble, but maybe her killing spree is what lets her zombie son return from the grave to wreak havoc on all sorts of camp counselors and teenage kids for generations to come.
You're right. That's a tremendously powerful portrait of motherhood, and I don't know who wouldn't want to be either the son or... I'm just going to move on to Mrs. Miniver from 1942. It's a Best Picture winning film that deals with World War II right as it was underway, and the outcome was still up in the air. So 42 still had, you know, a good amount of years to go. Mrs. Miniver is played by Greer Garson, and she and her family live in London at the time the bombing raids are going on. And the film, you know, it's a war movie, kind of, but really it's about showing how ordinary family life is displaced by the war, how it changes everyone's lives, even if they're not actively on the front lines. You're at home. You're supposed to be where it's safe. The war is somewhere else. But no, this war is just wreaking havoc on everyday lives. Things like going to flower shows, things like going to church, all the different, you know, the normal, people's normal lives that we think really ought to stay normal are put on hold as this war is going on. And it does get melodramatic at times. I think a couple of the episodes in this story, in this film, are probably a little far-fetched, but, you know, thematically it's solid, and I think it's very touching. And so it's really interesting to see not only this one woman coping with everything, but the whole family as well.
Interesting, yeah. Another interesting look at family dynamics, I think, is my number 5 pick, and that is the character Mrs. Lift from the 1987 film Throw Mama from the Train, the character played by Anne Ramsey. And this is a charming little movie starring Danny DeVito and Billy Crystal as these guys who become involved after Danny DeVito wants Billy Crystal to kill his mother, the aforementioned Mrs. Lift, who is just this lumbering, hulking, frightening creature who, you know, probably just has her son's best interest in mind, even if she is a total domineering shrew. Ramsey was actually nominated, surprisingly, for the Academy Award for this film for Best Supporting Actress. She didn't win, but, you know, a fun little movie about matricide. What's better than that?
Yeah, Anne Ramsey, the thing is, I think she's really too attractive for the movies. What do you think?
Yeah, you can't really believe that anyone would possibly look that good.
Yeah, it's just, yeah. All right, well, my number 4 choice is very intuitively named, and it's called Mother from 1996, an Albert Brooks comedy. Now, Albert Brooks, he's an adult. Things in life don't go exactly as he wanted them to, so he ends up moving back in with his mother, played by Debbie Reynolds. And it's always nice to see these stars from former eras return to the spotlight again, but, you know, show all these upstarts how it's done. It's just great to see Debbie Reynolds on the screen at her age in 1996. But Reynolds' character, interesting movie, because she starts out as sort of this comic stereotype, the kind of person that's unintentionally frustrating and just drive you mad because you don't even know she's doing it. Somebody's just so set in her ways and just assumes that everybody else wants things the way she wants them, and so she goes to arrange that, and then, you know, why did you do that? Well, as the movie progresses, you realize what a great affection it has for this character, and it really celebrates this relationship between mother and son. That's the real strength, I think, of Albert Brooks's best movies, I think. We should probably spotlight some of those someday. He understands relationships of various kinds, and he uses that understanding as the basis, the foundation for some really great and funny comedies.
Yeah, I love Albert Brooks, and that's a charming little film, but don't you feel like that Debbie Reynolds' character was really missing something? I really felt like she needed a samurai sword at least once in that film, which is why for my number 4 pick, I have chose The Bride, played by Uma Thurman from the 2 Kill Bill films, or the 1 Kill Bill film, depending on how you want to look at it. Kind of like my number 6 pick, Mrs. Voorhees, here's a character who's out to get revenge for the death of her unborn, at the time, daughter, and she has to just go on a bloody killing spree using mainly a katana as her weapon of choice, also sometimes other weapons. And, I mean, again, this is what you want your mom to do. You want her to just have enough love for you, or at least enough hate for everyone else, to be willing to kill a whole hell of a lot of people if something were to ever do something bad for you. And, of course, by the end of the second volume, she is able to hone her maternal skills a little more. I mean, I really feel like there's something that goes along with being a good mother as well as being a good warrior. What do you think?
You know what? I think, actually, I should have picked that one. That will surprise you. But, yeah, that's an absolutely amazing, powerful performance, certainly a role of a lifetime. Anyway, well, my number 3, I think, will also fit in pretty well with your list, actually. I'm going to take a dip on the dark side. And that is Angela Lansbury playing the absolute worst kind of mother in The Manchurian Candidate. She's just a force to be reckoned with. She's the woman pulling all the strings behind her son's political career. She's the one with the ambitions and the wiles. And ultimately, she winds up treating her son as kind of a pawn in this grander scheme. team. Although, you know, we're not really sure what her agenda is. We just know that we don't trust her. And Lansbury's performance, it just makes this one of the most evil and conniving of all movie women. It's really interesting, especially if you only know her from Murder, She Wrote, where she's this nice person, delicate, and you know, then you go back to earlier parts of her career, not just this role in The Manchurian Candidate, but a number of other roles that she used to play is quite diverse.
I think the most chilling thing about her performance and that whole character is the way that she deals with her son's love life. Man, that...
Yeah.
Ooh, how about a nice game of solitaire, huh?
You know something's messed up when that starts going on.
Well, my number three character is Sarah Connor, Linda Hamilton character from Terminator 2, especially. I guess, you know, she's also in Terminator 1, but really Terminator 2. Again, what kind of kid doesn't want their mom to teach them how to lead the eventual human revolt against the machines once the doomsday occurs? You know, she raises her son to learn all these skills like computer hacking and guns and teaches him lockpicking and all sorts of crazy stuff. And even when she's in a mental institution, she's still completely ripped and ready. I mean, that's who I want as my mom. I want Linda Hamilton to teach me how to be awesome.
I'm sensing a theme with your list.
What kind of theme would that be?
I'll need a few minutes to pin it down, I think.
Okay.
Well, my number two probably doesn't fit in, and it's from 1940's The Grapes of Wrath, one of the great books and a fantastic movie. It's one of the greatest movies of all time, I think. And in this adaptation from 1940, that's, of course, starring Henry Fonda, but it also stars Jane Darwell as Ma, and she is... Oh, gosh, what a performance. Just a pillar of strength and resolve. She's the focal point that kind of keeps the family together through all these difficult times. Every other character almost is crumbling and beaten by the situation of just starving during the Great Depression, not being able to find work, not getting treated kindly, and not getting any breaks at all. All the men and the other women just kind of gradually crumble at some point or another, and it's Ma, the Jane Darwell character, that holds them all together and keeps them going. And it's just a wonderful performance, too, just fantastic. I think that's really compelling about an elderly woman who is strong. You see it in Dame Judi Dench and a number of her, the roles that we see today. Back in the day, it was Jane Darwell.
Yeah, interesting. That's a good pick. I like that. My number two pick, though, is the one you did. In fact, I already correctly guessed I was going to grab Mrs. Islin, the Jessica Lansbury character from The Manchurian Candidate, so you can go ahead and go on.
Okay, well, my number one choice, movie that unfortunately almost nobody saw. I think it was record losing at the box office or something. Half the people haven't heard of it. Maybe the one reason is the title, not very compelling. The prize winner of Defiance, Ohio, and it was made in 2005, starring Julianne Moore as a mother of, I don't know, 10 or so, based on a true story of a family living in the 50s. The father is drunk and not a very good provider. He's a nice guy, more or less. I think he means well. He's just weak and can't really provide for the family. And this was at a time socially where, you know, it wasn't as acceptable for the mother of 10 to go out into the workforce, and that would have not been socially acceptable. It would have hurt his pride, and so he didn't want to have anything to do with that sort of thing. But she ends up finding a way to provide for her family by entering all these contests. Now, back in the day, the company would say, well, you know, we'll give away, oh, who knows what, a refrigerator, a car, a lifetime supply of Cheez-Its, whatever. If you can come up with the best jingle or the best poem or the best something or other, the best motto for our product. And she was just very good at this and wound up actually providing for her family, just entering all these contests and winning a lot of them. I mean, this actually happened. And in fact, some of the children were sort of, I'm not sure to what extent, but involved in the making of the movie, and including one of the children wrote the book that the movie is based on. And we do see some at the end of the movie. But Julianne Moore, I mean, what a fantastic actress anyway. I'd see anything with her in it. And I really loved this movie, not just her character, but as a movie as well. I think it was one of the great shames that this was overlooked.
Interesting. Giving the number one spot over to a little movie most people have not heard of. That's...
Yeah.
I wouldn't have predicted that. Unfortunately, I'm not that clever, and my number one is probably pretty dang predictable. But how could I resist picking Mrs. Bates, so memorably portrayed by Anthony Perkins in Hitchcock's classic film Psycho? technically, I guess, this character may not have exactly existed, but that's kind of a minor technicality, in my opinion. I mean, whether it's your actual mom or just you in drag pretending to be her and killing unsuspecting tourists, what better way is there to celebrate Mother's Day than by watching Psycho and just contemplating on the very special bond between a mother and her son?
All right, so your first, you know, whatever, four of your previous five picks were all about mothers killing to protect their kid, and this one, it's the mother that... Well, let's wrap up. My number six choice is Life with Father from 1947, and well, the character played by Irene Dunne in it. And number five, the title character in the movie Mrs. Miniver from 1942, played by Greer Garson. Number four, it's Debbie Reynolds in Mother from 96, the Albert Brooks comedy. Number three, Angela Lansbury in The Manchurian Candidate, the original version, not the remake, although the remake isn't as bad as you might think. Number two, Ma, played by Jane Darwell in The Grapes of Wrath from 1940. And number one, Julianne Moore in the prize winner of Defiance, Ohio from just a couple of years ago.
And my top six movie moms. Number six, Pamela Voorhees, played by Betsy Palmer in the original Friday the 13th film. Number five, Mrs. Lift, the Oscar-nominated role by Anne Ramsey in Throw Mama from the Train. Number four, Uma Thurman's The Bride from the two Kill Bill films. Number three, Sarah Connor, as played by Linda Hamilton in Terminator 2 Judgment Day. Number two, as on Sam's list, Jessica Lansbury's Mrs. Islin from the original Manchurian Candidate. And number one, my number one movie mom, Mrs. Bates in Psycho.
Once again, I am back with a trivia question that is quite impossible, and it's about who invented the frequency hop spread spectrum, which is a mouthful, but basically it's a way of using a piano roll, you know, one of those rolls of punched-out paper you see in a player piano, one of those things, using one of those to change between 88 different frequencies and thereby make radio-guided torpedoes harder to detect or to jam. And this invention was patented in 1942, not actually used until 1962, when it was used on military ships, U.S. military ships, during a blockade of Cuba. Now today, actually, we use this technology, this basic idea, in modern wireless devices, phones and Wi-Fi internet connections and so forth. So the frequency hop spread spectrum, invented by two people. One of them was George Antiel or something, I'm sure I botched that name. The other was a famous leading actress from the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And so, of course, our trivia question for this week is to name the actress I'm talking about. As I said, this question is quite impossible, but think of a guess anyway, and I'll get to the answer at the end of the show. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about widescreen, and this was primarily a way for movies to compete with television. We got another way that we want to talk about this week, and that is 3D, and this was a bit less successful. It never broke out of the novelty stage. I mean, these days everything is wider aspect ratio than it used to be, but we don't see 3D movies absolutely everywhere. So let's talk a bit about what we mean when we say 3D, because obviously you're still seeing an image on a flat screen. The way we perceive depth in real life, one of the ways, we'll talk a little bit more a little bit later, but one of the ways is the difference in what the left eye sees versus what the right eye sees. Your left eye sees things at just a slightly different angle than your right eye does, and so your brain picks up on these differences and perceives depth from them. So if you watch a 3D movie, 3D movies are going to try to simulate this effect where the left eye sees one image and the right eye sees a slightly different one, and our brains will perceive the depth from the differences in the normal way that it is used to doing. So 3D movies are going to be all about trying to pull this off. Obviously, you're going to need two different views of a particular scene, and there's different ways to mesh them together in a way that your brain can do its magic on them. Well, you might think that 3D, I guess when we talk about 3D, it's primarily a thing that comes to light in the 50s, and that's going to be one of the many spectacle kinds of things that you can go away from your TV set, out of the house, go to the movies to see. It's a 3D film. But as we talked about with sound, as we talked about with widescreen and with color, you know, all these things actually came way earlier on. And 3D systems, the first one started in the late 1890s, very early. quickly I thought of an idea. Project two images side by side on a screen. Just see one right next to the other and look at the screen through a stereoscope. So that's going to be the first 3D system. It's pretty impractical for theater use to just say, you know, here's your stereoscope and try to focus your eyes on it and not get a headache. But in 1900, a movie camera was invented that had two different lenses, an inch and three quarters apart, to simulate the two different views of something you might see if you're viewing it with both of your eyes. And this is going to be another step in this direction. And basically, throughout the teens and the 20s, there are these occasional forays and experiments into working with 3D. In 1922, we get the first exhibition of 3D film for a paying audience. And the way that was is what's called red-green anaglyph format, where so you have one image projected in red and the other image projected in green, and you wear these color-tinted glasses. So one lens is red and one's green, so the green filters out the green things, and you only see the red through that eye, and vice versa for the other eye. And so then you get each eye seeing a different image. And this is going to be more or less how a lot of 3D processes work for decades to come. I mean, I think we're still familiar, even if we don't see it everywhere, with this idea of these color-tinted glasses. Lots of times it's red and blue rather than red and green. But this, 1922, is the first known time when this process was actually used. And maybe one of the reasons it catches on is it's a pretty cheap process. You just shoot the footage and distribute the glasses. And these could be cardboard glasses. They don't have to be anything expensive. The colored film you get when you project the film, you could either tint it, because this would be pretty much all black and white film. You could tint it yourself, or you could just project the film through a colored filter. Either way would work. But also in 1922, we get the debut of another 3D system that has a much shorter lifespan, and it's called Teleview. And basically what you had is these two interlocked projectors that would interleave the frames from two different reels of film. So you get one frame from one reel, and then one frame from the other, and then the next frame from the first reel, and the next one from the other, and so on. And so you'd have these special viewing devices that are attached to the armrests of the seats. They just plunk it onto the armrest, and it would be something that kind of hovers in front of your face, and you look through it, kind of binocular-like things. But there's a shutter in each eye that would open and close in sync with the film. And so the left eye would see all the frames from one reel, and the right eye would see all the frames from the other reel. And obviously this was going to be a more expensive system. I'm sure these shutter devices were not cheap to manufacture, you know, one per seat in a movie theater. And so, ultimately, they only ever make one movie with Teleview, but I guess people liked it. Shortly later, though, a guy named Edwin Land invented Polaroid filters. Originally, his plan was to get rid of the glare from car headlights, but in the 1930s, he moved into using polarized light as a way of projecting 3D images. Now, polarization, you go look it up on Wikipedia for the complicated explanation, but basically, it's the direction that light waves oscillate. And so you have might have light waves that oscillate up and down or side to side or in a spiral or some kind of elliptical pattern in one direction or the other. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about polarization. And so the idea is with film, you have two reels of film, just like in, you know, the other systems, and then you project each image using differently polarized light onto the same surface. And so you wear these special glasses. Each lens filters out the light that the other eye should be seeing. So you know, if the left eye is supposed to see light waves going up and down, and the right eye is supposed to see the ones going side to side, you get these different Polaroid lenses that filter out the correct type of light, and then each eye only sees the image that it's supposed to. And this comes across much better than messing with the colors. For one thing, you don't mess with the colors. But to do this, you also have to change the screen that you're projecting on, because if you just project the images onto a white wall somewhere, for example, or some kind of matte surface, it changes the polarity of the light when it bounces off the screen and back toward your eye. So the screens had to be highly reflective as opposed to refractive. The more reflective the surface is, the more intact the polarity of the light will be when it gets bounced back. And so what they wound up doing was using silver screens. Literally, the term silver screen as we use it today means there's silver in the screen. And they used silver screens before 3D, but it turned out to be really, really good with 3D. Silver is very reflective. And so that's where that term silver screen comes from. Now today, We still use silver screens for 3D projection, not so much for 2D, but we still call it the silver screen because that's how the term came to be known, is just to refer to any movie theater screen. Anyway, this process comes to light by 1939, and this movie, In Tune with Tomorrow, becomes the first Polaroid 3D film screen for a paying audience. And eventually you get up to the early 50s, and just 3D becomes this huge fad. This is the real golden age of 3D movies. Buona Devil becomes the first full-length color 3D film, and like most of those that follow it, Buona Devil, okay? Most of them are all going to be about crazy B-movies with monsters and sci-fi adventure horror and all that kind of stuff. Very, very B-movie type things. Very much in the tradition of the old serials from the 30s and 40s, these thrills a minute kind of things. My favorite 3D title is Catwomen of the Moon. Pretty much sums up the kind of movies being made here. It sounds great, doesn't it? Catwomen of the Moon.
It sure does.
But they also had other things on occasion, like Kiss Me, Kate, the MGM musical. But anyway, the next year we get House of Wax with Vincent Price, which is the first real stereo sound film, and that was in 3D, and Vincent Price would sort of become the king of 3D movies. It was right up his alley. But the fad died out pretty quickly in just a couple of years. Part of it is because there's still these technical problems. It's a delicate process. For example, if one of the shutters went out of sync or something in the projection, the image suddenly becomes very unwatchable and everybody gets headaches because you got one image not projecting quite right and the other one is, and you just get this really jarring sensation. Or let's say one of the reels of film becomes damaged in some spot, okay? Now, if this happens with just a regular 2D film, you get out a pair of scissors, you cut a couple of frames out, the damaged frames, and you tape it back together. I mean, it can be that crude, and maybe nobody would even notice, but that's not that invasive a process. With 3D film, if you take one frame out of one reel and not also the corresponding frame in the other reel, well, suddenly your film's out of sync, and people walk forward, and they're jittering back and forth, and it'd be all out of sync, and, it's just going to be horrendous to try to watch. The other problem is that polarized light can be sensitive to the angle you're viewing from, so in these wide theaters, you got these seats way out on the sides. Viewing experience is not going to be very good there, as opposed to if you were in the center. So there are a number of things like that that made the process of projecting 3D films more tedious and expensive. And so 3D kind of falls out of favor again, especially with audiences being distracted by other things like CinemaScope and stereo sound. I mean, they got their sensation from other places, more solid areas of technology. So people, don't really go to 3D. Things do improve over the decades, though. Like, for example, in 1970, we get this thing called StereoVision, which is a single-strip process where you got these anamorphic lenses that are used to squeeze images for both eyes onto the same strip of film. It's not as good resolution, but it was cheaper. And, since then we've had these periodic points where 3D becomes a fad again for a couple of years, and then it goes away again. It's kind of weird. In the early 80s, the thing to do was to release part 3 of your horror series in 3D, whether that was Friday the 13th or Jaws or Amityville or whatever. That was just the thing to do in the early 80s. And then I think we're also in the middle of another revival of the fad, because in part, there's a new IMAX process for 3D that was really nice and crisp. It looks a lot better than earlier 3D processes. It's not as sensitive to direction and a lot of other things like that. And so the Polar Express was released in some IMAX theaters in 3D and a whole ton of regular theaters in 2D, and it wound up making just tons of money in the 3D theaters, despite there not being very many of them. And so that people will realize, there's money here. So they started making all kinds of 3D stuff, and Robert Rodriguez made a couple of 3D movies, and now we got Meet the Robinsons in theaters and stuff like that. So I think we're kind of in the middle of a 3D revival, but I'm not sure it's going to last. And, here's the thing about 3D. I think 3D is pretty cool. I mean, I went to see the Polar Express in 3D. I loved it. I mean, I loved the movie, but I also loved the 3D experience. But I don't know, I can't help but think that 3D is essentially a gimmick, and ultimately, unless your movie is all about playing around with the 3D visuals, I can't help but think it's more of a distraction than anything. Like, maybe if you think back with the widescreen segment a couple of weeks ago, we talked about these projecting a 360-degree view of a movie, and so you have the surrounding experience. I mean, that's cool. Sure, that's cool, but can you imagine watching a real movie that way when you're not even sure necessarily where to look? I don't know. What do you think, Steven?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Because the illusion of depth in 2D is sufficient. I mean, we've had it for thousands of years, if you go back to,
right.
You know, just think of paintings and stuff. So I'm just wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
I think once we, if we get, like, holographic projection kind of systems, then maybe. But I don't think, you know, currently we're going anywhere near it. I do like having it around, though, as sort of a spectacle kind of thing in special theaters, the IMAX process. I think that's kind of neat. I think people obviously like that. But, yeah, I mean, what do you really gain from 3D? What do you gain from having things in 3D for most movies?
Yeah. I think the motivation is, all right, let's do everything we can, and not just the motivation for this 3D thing, but anything really. Let's try to make the experience of watching a movie or even, you know, playing a game, a video game or something, as close to reality as we can, and that will make it better. And I think that's the fallacy, is that maybe it would make it better in some cases. It certainly makes it a great thrill ride. But, you know, books haven't gone away, and that's storytelling process that's absolutely nothing like real life. You know, it's not like movies being a little bit closer to life has replaced reading books, although maybe it has for some, but...
Well, not movies so much as television.
Yeah, maybe so. So I'm not, you know, down on 3D as a tool, but I think when we talk about 3D, we should be careful to say, all right, this is not necessarily an improvement, it's just something that's kind of neat to have in certain areas. It's time to wrap up our series on the Looney Tunes. Last week we talked about four of the seven major directors. I want you to recall what we said about Bob Clampett, who is arguably who influenced the Looney Tunes the most during the 1940s. Just a quick reminder, his style was all-out zaniness, much like his mentor Tex Avery, but even more so. Anything could happen in his cartoons as long as it got a laugh. He set the characters loose. And so we'll contrast that a little bit with the directors we'll talk about this week, starting with the incredibly popular Chuck Jones. Jones and Clampett both started out as animators on Tex Avery's cartoons, and they both got promotions to director, but their styles are kind of opposite extremes. You know, Clampett was all about breaking the rules and going nuts, and Jones was all about rules and control and structure. And this mode of thinking sort of gradually developed through the 40s, but certainly by the 50s we can see that Jones has solidified his process, and it's also influenced his contemporaries. And in fact, they apply to comedy in general when you think about it. The philosophy is that comedy and characters and stories work best if there are some basic rules at the core that people can latch onto, that anchors everything. For example, the rule for Bugs Bunny is that Bugs never initiates hostilities. If Bugs is engaged in some private war with Elmer Fudd or Daffy Duck or Yosemite Sam, or even more minor characters like the Crusher, you know, from that wrestling cartoon, whatever, it's always Bugs that gets bullied around first, and then he comes out with that classic line, you know, "Of course, you know, this means war." And then Bugs punishes the guy for the rest of the cartoon. It's a way of keeping Bugs sympathetic despite always being a winner in engagements. And, you know, if you look at some of the other directors' Bugs Bunny cartoons, sometimes they do this and sometimes they don't do that. But Chuck Jones always did. And the Roadrunner cartoons were all Chuck Jones's. He created the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote and directed all of those. The Roadrunner cartoons were laden with rules. I mean, the Roadrunner may not leave the road. He can't harm the coyote. The coyote only gets harmed by his own mistakes, and he must always be more humiliated than damaged, and so on. There's a bunch of rules. The downside is, you know, each cartoon feels more or less like all the others. That's one of the criticisms. But the upside is obvious. I mean, look at how many creative gags there are in these, and they feel fresh and exciting every single time, and they remain really popular, particular favorites, I think, for a lot of people, because the formula is solid and it works. But it also allows latitude for all kinds of different slapstick comedy within that. So that was one of Jones's big things, is what are the rules, and now let's work within them. The other major creation of Chuck Jones's was Pepe Le Pew, created in 1945 and coming into his own sort of as a character in 49, for sentimental reasons, wins the Best Animated Short Oscar in that year. And obviously this series has its own rules as well, but he knew how to break out of the rules when it was necessary too. For example, in 1948 he realized that Bugs Bunny was too good at outwitting Elmer Fudd and Yosemite Sam. So he created Marvin the Martian, and it was as a guy who was more legitimately dangerous and harder for Bugs to foil, you know, perhaps because he's so quiet and oblivious, more or less. He's determined. And so, you know, Bugs has well practiced it at putting these loud, blustery characters in their places, but here's a guy he doesn't know what to make of. And so that was a successful pairing. And he reinvented a couple of classic characters too, like Porky Pig, who was a sentimental favorite at the studio, being such an early character. But he had, you know, by the time of the 50s or so, he had been supplanted by wackier characters. Well, Chuck Jones made him a sidekick to Daffy Duck in things like Duck Dodgers in the 24th and a half century and Robin Hood Daffy and stuff like that. And as for Daffy Duck himself, he certainly changed more than any other character. I mean, under Avery and Clampett, he was this completely insane, uncontrollable nutcase who was a foil for the straight man, maybe Porky Pig or something. And Chuck Jones was the guy that adapted him into somebody that could be a great foil for Bugs Bunny, and now it's the reverse. Jones's Daffy Duck was jealous and greedy and scheming and everything. Many people, including myself, make a case for Chuck Jones as the best Looney Tunes director. His resume speaks for itself, I think. I mean, he did Duck Amuck, which is the one where Daffy is at war with a mischievous unseen animator, and Rabbit of Seville, which sets a Elmer Fudd duel to the opera, and What's Opera, Doc?, which does the same sort of thing with Wagner. And he did One Froggy Evening with the singing frog, Michigan J. Frog, he was retroactively named. And he did the so-called Hunting Trilogy, these three cartoons where Elmer Fudd is pitted against both Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck. You know, Rabbit Season, Duck Season, Rabbit Season, all that stuff. That was Chuck Jones' doing, too. He was a brilliant character director, great character dynamics in his cartoons, especially those hunting ones. I mean, you got Daffy Duck trying to manipulate both the other two characters and Bugs defending himself against both but not expending any effort, and Elmer just does what he's told. Well, anyway, these are also great examples of Jones's animation style, which is another important thing to talk about, especially in comparison with Clampett. Because I said, Clampett's cartoons were especially popular with animators because he would free them to do whatever animation, you know, was called for, to go loose on their own styles. Jones's cartoons, especially later on, are much more focused on the single image and comic timing. So Elmer Fudd shoots Daffy in the face, and Bob Clampett would just have all kinds of wacky, crazy animation to show how Daffy is just blown away by the shot. Well, in the Chuck Jones cartoons, you get this puff of smoke, and when it clears, you know, his beak is way up in his head or something like that, and he's still. And maybe he blinks, but that's it. There's this comic beat while Daffy is humiliated by his own strategic error, usually. And that would never just happen in a Clampett cartoon. So it's brilliant, but it's just a different kind of comedy. And as time wore on, some critics say Jones, despite being, you know, the absolute master of comic timing, just got too possessive of his key frames, you know, on his single images, and kept his animators on a short leash. By the way, his drawings themselves are pretty distinctive from other animators. You can get to recognize a Jones drawing pretty easily sometimes, especially in the eyes of certain expressions that were only his. Yeah, actually, you know, the cat in Shrek 2, he has this incredibly pitiful expression he can put on. Pupils get all big and he looks all pathetic, and that was try to win sympathy. I mean, Jones used that kind of expression a lot in his cartoons. But, I'm getting off track. He was very focused on the single image, and that touches on the whole debate between full animation and partial animation, which becomes an issue in the cost-cutting 60s, not for Looney Tunes, but for animation in general. Partial animation would be what you often see on TV because of low budgets. If a guy is standing there talking, only his mouth is moving, and maybe the angle of his head might be animated, but the rest of his body is still. It's the same drawing, very cheap to make that kind of cartoon. You don't have to draw the whole body over and over again for every frame. Jones hated that partial animation style, but, you know, some critics say he kind of pioneered it. I don't know. Definitely in the 40s, though, you don't see anything remotely resembling partial animation, even in Jones' own cartoons. It's just they took a lot of time to make things look lively, and I think that's one of the reasons that these cartoons remain popular over time. Well, outside the Warner Brothers studio, Jones was involved in a number of artistic projects and efforts to advance the art of animation. He was quite a guy who was interested in the artistry and directed a number of things like How the Grinch Stole Christmas, that Christmas special that's probably the best one of those types of things that airs on TV every year. Well, anyway, we'll move on to our next director, Friz Freleng, and sometimes you see him credited as I. Freleng, the initial I. Friz was a nickname, and he was the director of the very first Looney Tune. He worked with animators Harmon and Ising, who were producers as well, not just animators, and the three of them made the first Looney Tune with Bosco in 1930, and the other two left the studio, but Freleng stayed on and directed Looney Tunes right up to the end, except for 3 years in the late 30s, but he really carried on the torch for probably the longest time, and didn't have a huge amount of influence in the beginning, because Avery and Clampett were sort of defining cartoons until World War II, but then Freleng and Jones become the dominant directors, and his style was similar to Jones's. He wasn't as focused on the rules and single images, but they have a similar sense of humor and comic timing to them. And he was very musically minded, too. I mean, you know, Jones made some of the big operatic musical ones, but Freeling's were probably the most musically inclined. Even the ones that weren't overtly musical, they adhered to musical rhythms. It's a kind of a nice touch. And he created a number of his own characters. Yosemite Sam was his. He didn't think you could make a lot of hunting pictures with Elmer Fudd. He wanted more versatility. And so Yosemite Sam, I mean, he could be a gunfighter, a pirate, a Hessian, a medieval knight, a legionnaire, whoever. And Mel Blanc, incidentally, had a tough time voicing him, because it basically meant he had to yell at the top of his lungs. He always had to record Sam's lines at the end of the day so he wouldn't be hoarse for the other characters. And Freleng also created Sylvester the Cat. He didn't create Tweety, that was Clampett, but he was the first to pair those two up. And that started a whole series of cartoons that were mostly all his, although, as we said earlier, you know, other directors used Sylvester in different ways. And finally, he created Speedy Gonzales in conjunction with Robert McKimson, and they shared those cartoons. And that came along pretty late, not until 1955 or so. Some sources say Freleng didn't really like the character that much. Others say he really did because of the speed of the character. Let him pack a lot of action into a single cartoon. And by contrast, he definitely did not like the sidekick Slowpoke Rodriguez because he was so slow and it took forever for him to say anything. And, you know, these cartoons were about 7 minutes long on average. Screen time was important. Freleng was the most decorated of the Looney Tunes directors. He got 4 Academy Awards for his work. There weren't a lot that were doled out to the Warner Brothers studio. I think Disney was taking most of the ones for animation, but he took 4 just with his own cartoons. And after the animation studio at Warner closed, he moved on and made the Pink Panther cartoons. And like Chuck Jones, did continue to be involved in odd Looney Tunes projects throughout the years. And finally, we come to the last one, and that's Robert McKimson. Started working under Bob Clampett as an animator, was later promoted to director, and his directorial work can be thought of as sort of a continuation and a reaction to Clampett's style. His characters were expressive and hyper and kinetic and everything, but he kind of adhered to the rules thing like Jones did as well. So there's sort of almost a disconnect. You almost kind of feel like there's a tension there between different styles when you watch his cartoons. He wasn't the craftsman that Jones and Freleng were, but he was a wonderful artist. I mean, he was the one that created the definitive look for Bugs Bunny, for example. He did the character sheet for him that wound up being used by everybody else thereafter. And he drew that, you know, there's that iconic pose as he's leaning up against a tree and looking out at the camera and eating a carrot. And he drew that. That's the iconic image of Bugs Bunny. But some critics think he was a better animator than director, though. And I think that's a little unfair, but it does bring up the point that there are different skills involved. As a director, McKimson, you kind of get the sense that he wanted to be animating because he wound up being very protective of his keyframes, and so the animators didn't have a lot of latitude that, say, Clampett's animators had. But many of his cartoons are pretty great, and he had his own share of characters that he created and made into icons. The Tasmanian Devil was one of them. I loved the Tasmanian Devil as a kid. I mean, still do. And, you know, it says something about how memorable the character is. Everybody knows him. He only appeared in 5 cartoons before the studio closed. That's it. And part of that was because Eddie Selzer, if you remember from 2 weeks ago, I don't know, he was the cartoon producer at Warner Brothers and just had no idea what he was doing. He'd always say, don't do this, and they'd do it anyway, and it would be a big hit. Well, he said after the first Tasmanian Devil cartoon, he's too obnoxious, don't use him anymore. So McKimson had to shelve the character for a while, and then eventually Jack Warner called up and said, hey, how come there aren't any more Tasmanian Devil cartoons? We're getting boxes and boxes of fan letters about him. So, you know, Selzer had to let McKimson do more.
How exactly did the Selzer guy keep his job?
Selzer? I do not know. Maybe it's because the people under him were so successful at making him look good, you know. That's the only thing I can think. I mean, they certainly, as Jones said, you know, he gave them something to push against, and so they were kind of motivated to be aggressive in their creativity.
So it was like, if Selzer doesn't like it, we should keep on doing it, because it's obviously a good idea?
Yeah, exactly. If he didn't like an idea, they would purposely go for it. It's the definitive pointy-haired boss. Anyway, McKimson also created Foghorn Leghorn and Hippity Hopper. And that's the kangaroo, you know, that's always throwing Sylvester around. And he directed all those cartoons. And Foghorn Leghorn, obviously, is, you know, he's the loudmouth southern rooster. And I didn't think much of him as a kid, actually. They weren't my favorite cartoons. But as an adult, I sort of rediscovered him and love the character now. Very funny. Even though, this is interesting, the character's really a badly dated spoof of a character on a radio show at the time. It was Senator Claghorn, who appeared on the Fred Allen comedy variety show. Claghorn was this diehard southern politician who was always saying things like, that's a joke, son. I say that's a joke, son. I mean, that was his trademark line. And he was so popular in the day, he even started a movie called That's a Joke, Son. And actually, it's not bad. I've seen it. But today, nobody remembers this guy, and yet Foghorn Leghorn is still popular. So it's an interesting situation. It's usually, in some of these Looney Tunes that are parodies of contemporary things, do look quite a bit dated, but this one doesn't. Well, anyway, this wraps up our series on the Looney Tunes, and, you know, again, I think they're often kind of remembered as kid stuff. They were popular as the kids, then you grow up and you kind of forget, or you don't really realize that there's a lot of great stuff in there. They're not just cultural icons or kid stuff. I mean, they're really well-crafted comedy and animation. And if you're interested in either one, you know, these would be worth seeking out. Fortunately, Warner Brothers has been producing some wonderful DVD sets of them, the Golden Collections. Don't look at the other types of collections. The Golden Collections are the ones you want. They're four to date. Each volume has four DVDs, and I honestly think they are the best put-together DVDs I've seen. I mean, the restoration work is gorgeous, but the extras are incredible. I mean, lots of this stuff, they could have made money selling on their own dedicated DVDs, and they just throw it on as an extra. Great commentaries, too. Highly recommended.
Continuing with our discussion of various techniques used in cinematography, we're going to talk about two techniques that make similar use of perspective. And perspective is just the word for kind of judging how we see things, especially how we determine distance. The number one way that you're just sort of looking at things with your eyes you use to determine distance is by the size of objects. You know that objects that are closer to you appear larger, and objects that are further away appear smaller. I mean, this is kind of the thing where, like, you know the actual size of two objects, so you can tell which one's closer if one seems out of proportion. You know, if you sort of, like, hold your arm out all the way, and you put your thumb up to the sun and look up in the sky, your thumb appears about the same size. Obviously, though, you know that your thumb is much, much smaller than the sun. At least I hope you know that. So you know that, obviously, your thumb is much closer to you than the sun. It's also why the sun and the moon appear to be roughly the same size most of the time in the sky. It's because, though the sun dwarfs the moon is much closer to us, so it appears larger. You also have another way of judging distance, and it's based on the fact that you have two eyes. So, essentially, you're gathering visual data from two sources that are not set equally. You know, they're separated by a couple inches. And this is sort of what provides what we generally call depth perception, and it has to do with this fact that your brain takes these two different data sources, and it does a weird kind of calculation. It's sort of like a triangulation. It's called parallax, or at least one form of parallax, where you can say, oh, okay, look, I can kind of get an idea of how far away they are by judging how this thing differs from me. For instance, you know, something that's really close looks a lot different in one eye than it does the other. You know, hold your finger right up by your face, right in front of your right eye,
and then close one eye and then the other, and your finger appears to move. Really far objects, this doesn't happen because, you know, it's too far away for you to notice this. So your brain kind of does this subconsciously. And it's one reason why when you close one eye, you lose depth perception. Now you're gonna, you don't have this sort of what's called the stereoscopic effect, where you can't tell this depth perception. And it's kind of the same way that a ViewMaster works. If you remember those old toys as a kid, you put them with your eyes and it had the slide and it looked 3D. Well, it was because you were actually looking at two images that were separated and they were aligned correctly to fool your eyes into thinking that you were actually seeing 3D images. It was taking advantage of the fact that you can do this. And there are a couple other things that we subconsciously do to achieve depth perception. For instance, we compare the way that objects move against a stationary background. If two objects are kind of moving, or you're moving, and a background appears stationary, like if you watch a plane moving against the sky at night, you know, you see the lights of the plane moving against the static star field, you can tell, okay, the plane's going to be closer than the star field, kind of by judging it. And you also know that, like, parallel lines converge to a single point, the vanishing point on the horizon. You know, if you're standing on a pair of train tracks looking into the distance, you know that the tracks are parallel, but they appear to converge together, so you know that, you know, where they're converging is far away in the horizon. And there's all these kind of tricks that we do that we don't even think about to judge depth. Now, movies can completely exploit this fact and trick us, and this is partially because cameras, you can control very precisely what you want them to show, and because they don't function the same way as eyes. They function similarly, but there are specific differences in camera lenses. Now, one of these big differences is, I think we've mentioned it before, and it has to do with what's called depth of field. The human eye has a pretty wide depth of field generally, but there are some instances. If you hold something right up to your face, you can choose either to focus on it or to focus on the distance. You can't focus on something in the very near foreground and very far away at all. You're very shallow up close. However, a wide-angle lens can focus on things really close to it, as well as everything else in the background. And this is what's called deep focus, and this is sort of the first technique that we're going to be mentioning, and the second technique is very closely related. So it's interesting because a camera obviously does not have the stereoscopic effect. You have no depth perception. A camera is like just one source. It's like looking at everything through one eye. So really, you have these sort of techniques we talked about, you know, parallel lines, converging, that kind of thing. But the main way we tell how close objects are when looking at them through a camera is simply by their size and their focus. If you make everything in focus, then all you have left is size, so you expect objects that are bigger to be closer. But you can kind of do the opposite with this. And this is called forced perspective. If you take a small object and put it really close to the camera, the object will appear really large, but because everything in the frame is in focus, you can't tell where it is except by its relationship to other things. So, sort of the classic example of this is, you take a little toy dinosaur, you put it right in front of the camera when everything's in focus, and then off in the distance, you have some actors who are screaming in terror. Now, we don't have any focus to tell where anything is in relationship to one another. The entire image appears kind of flat. But the dinosaur looks like it dwarfs the humans, and they're screaming. And so we think, oh, the dinosaur's huge. Those guys are going to get eaten, and they're running in terror. And so this was used very frequently in old monster movies, especially before CGI, because, okay, great. You can just go ahead and take a plastic model and stick it in front of the camera and have people running in terror from it. You could also use it in other kind of interesting ways. If you want to build a model of like a really cool building or something, like a castle, you make it a small little model and you put it a couple feet away from the camera, and then it looks gigantic, which is perfect because everything's in focus again, and we don't know. It just seems to be in the distance.
There's a neat use for doing this besides just it's cheaper to build a small model, of course. But I was recently watching the James Bond movies over again. We'll talk about that later, but there's a couple of scenes where they used this idea of forced perspective or foreground miniatures, to be more specific in this use, to allow them to get shots of aircraft flying into buildings. There's a shot in the beginning of For Your Eyes Only and another one in the beginning of Octopussy where a helicopter and then a plane, a jet, go into a building and then fly through it, fly out the other end. Well, they can't do this for real. I mean, it's too dangerous for a stunt guy to do it, and probably the city wouldn't give him permits to do this anyway. So what they do is they take an existing building and have a foreground miniature of the front of the building, and it's absolutely perfectly matched. I freeze frame the DVDs. You can't tell where the division is, but it is there. The part of the building that conceals the aircraft is a foreground miniature. It's very small, very close to the camera, and actually these aircraft are just flying in front of the back part of the building, if you can visualize that. So you can do a lot of tricky special effects with that technique that aren't just the obvious, you know, let's make a monster look really huge. There's a lot of interesting uses for that.
Absolutely. And also for deep focus, you know, there's some interesting artistic uses. You can really make things look funky just because we're so not used to it. The classic example is Citizen Kane, which is the movie that really pioneered deep focus, especially here in America. Cinematographer Greg Tolan really famously really pushed for this, and there's all sorts of course, all those crazy shots from weird angles, but then we also screw around with your focus. So not only do we have weird angles, but you have things that just don't seem quite right, things that are unnaturally distorted in terms of size. And I mean, I think we've talked about it ad nauseum, that scene in Kane where he walks to the curtains that appear to be a normal size when he's far away from them, then he gets close to them, and you can tell that they're actually gigantic and dwarfing him, and it's a weird change of the way we view the set without actually changing anything at all, just, you know, because relative size gets all thrown off. It's a really cool, neat effect.
Earlier in the show, we, of course, had a trivia question, as we always do. And just to give you a quick reminder, it was to name one of the co-inventors of the frequency-hopped spread spectrum, this idea of rotating between frequencies. It was designed for radio-guided torpedoes, but used pervasively today, still used in modern wireless technology. So, Stephen, do you think you could take a shot in the dark here and not injure anybody too badly? Talking about a leading lady we're looking for from the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Who invented this? No, I have no... I'm not even guessing, man. This is impossible. I protest.
That's a wise decision. I'm sure I wouldn't have gotten it either, although I do know the actress. It's Hedy Lamarr.
Oh, really? What?
Probably, yeah. She was probably a lot more famous in her day than today, but her name is probably quite familiar if you watch a lot of older movies, and she was a major leading actress, kind of the, not quite the popularity, but the appeal of Rita Hayworth and Betty Grable, that sort of actress. And actually, if you know the movie Blazing Saddles, it might be more familiar to you. Her name is a running joke in that, where it's Hedy Lamarr, and actually it's kind of funny because it's a joke that, we can't use that because they'll sue us, and she really did sue over the use of her name in that movie, but I guess they settled for something minor. But anyway, it's interesting that she has such an impact on our modern everyday lives, but it's not what she's famous for. That's it for episode 32. Of course, we'll be back with another episode. And of course, you can go to our website, allmovietalk.com. That's allmovietalk.com. Just in case you're spelling impaired, but you can go there and check out all kinds of movie-related posts that we make there. We just, whatever pops into our mind about movies, we'll just slap it up there, and you can read it, and somehow that's fun. So what do we got next week, Steven?
Oh, boy. We have a director spotlight on Stan the Man Kubrick,
ooh,
which I'm so excited for. Our top six, so if you're playing along, you want to get your own top six ready, it's going to be on robot movies, and I'll also have a how-to guide on how to be the slasher from a slasher movie, so check back then on May 15th.
Cut. I suppose this is where I tell a funny joke.